He shook his head.
Her husband is dead. Whether she was fond of him or no, she is mistress here now, with none to answer to. And she enjoys the taste of power too well to spit it out.
He was plainly correct in this assessment of Jocasta Cameron's character, and therein lay the key to her plan. She needed a man, someone to go into those places she could not go, to deal with the Navy, to handle the chores of a large estate that she couldn't manage because of her blindness. At the same time, she patently did not want a husband, someone who would usurp her power and dictate to her. Had he not been a slave, Ulysses could have acted for her. But while he could be her eyes and ears, he couldn't be her hands. No, Jamie was the perfect choice. A strong, competent man, able to command respect among peers, compel obedience in subordinates. One knowledgeable in the management of land and men. Furthermore, a man bound to her by kinship and obligation, there to do her bidding, but essentially powerless. He would be held in thrall by dependence upon her bounty and by the rich bribe of River Run itself. A debt that needn't be paid until the matter was no longer of any earthly concern to Jocasta Cameron. There was an increasing lump in my throat as I sought for words. I couldn't, I thought. I couldn't manage it. But I couldn't face the alternative either. I couldn't urge him to reject Jocasta's offer, knowing it would send him to Scotland to meet an unknown death. "I can't say what you should do," I finally said, my voice barely audible above the regular lap of the oars. There was an eddy pool where a large tree had fallen into the water, its branches forming a trap for all the debris that had drifted downstream. Jamie made for this, backing the rowboat neatly into quiet water. He let down the oars and wiped a sleeve across his forehead, breathing heavily from exertion. The night was quiet around us, with little sound but the lapping of water, and the occasional scrape of submerged tree branches against the hull. At last he reached out and touched my chin.
"Your face is my heart, Sassenach," he said softly, "and love of you is my soul. But you're right. You canna be my conscience."
In spite of everything, I felt a lightening of spirit, as though some indefinable burden had dropped away. "Oh, I'm glad," I said, adding impulsively, "it would be a terrible strain."
"Why?"
He looked mildly startled.
"You think me very wicked, then?"
"You're the best man I've ever met," I said. "I only meant... it's such a strain to try to live for two people. To try to make them fit your ideas of what's right.
You do it for a child, of course. You have to.
But even then, it's dreadfully hard work. I couldn't do it for you. It would be wrong even to try." I'd taken him back more than a little. He sat for some moments, his face half turned away.
"Do you really think me a good man?" he said at last.
There was a queer note in his voice that I couldn't quite decipher. "Yes," I said, with no hesitation, then added half-jokingly, "don't you?" After a long pause, he said quite seriously,
"No, I shouldn't think so."
I looked at him, speechless, no doubt with my mouth hanging open.
"I'm a violent man, and I ken it well," he said quietly.
He spread his hands out on his knees, big hands which could wield sword and dagger with ease, or choke the life from a man.
"So do you. Or you should.
You've never done anything you weren't forced to do."
"No,
I don't think so," I said. But even as I spoke, a shadow of doubt clouded my words. Even when done from the most urgent necessity, did such things not leave a mark on the soul?
"You wouldn't hold me in the same estimation as, say, a man like Stephen Bonnet. He might well say he acted from necessity."
"If you think you have the slightest thing in common with Stephen Bonnet, you're dead wrong," I said firmly. He shrugged, half impatient, and shifted restlessly on the narrow bench.
There's nae much to choose between Bonnet and me, save that I have a sense of honour that he lacks. What else keeps me from turning thief, he demanded, from plundering those whom I might? It's in me to do it. My one grandsire built Leoch on the gold of those he robbed in the Highland passes. The other built his fortune on the bodies of women whom he forced for their wealth and titles.
He stretched himself, powerful shoulders rising dark against the shimmer of the water behind him. Then he suddenly took hold of the oars across his knees and flung them into the bottom of the boat with a crash that made me jump.
"I am more than 45, he said. "A man should be settled at that age, no? He should have a house and some land to grow his food, and a bit of money put away to see him through his old age at the least."
He took a deep breath. I could see the white bosom of his shirt rise with his swelling chest.
"Well, I dinna have a house, or land, or money. Not a croft, not a tatty plot, not a cow or a sheep or a pig or a goat. I havena got a roof tree or a bedstead or a pot to piss in."
He slammed his fist down on the thwart, making the wooden seat vibrate under me.
"I dinna own the clothes I stand up in."
There was a long silence, broken only by the thin song of crickets. "You have me," I said, in a small voice. It didn't seem a lot. He made a small sound in his throat that might have been either a laugh or a sob.
"Aye, I have," he said.
His voice was quivering a bit, though whether with passion or amusement I couldn't tell.
"That's the hell of it, aye."
"It is?" He threw up his hand in a gesture of profound impatience.
"If it was only me, what would it matter? I could live like Myers, go to the woods, hunt and fish for my living. And when I was too old, lie down under a peaceful tree and die, and let the foxes gnaw my bones. Who would care?"
He shrugged his shoulders with irritable violence, as though his shirt was too tight.
"But it's not only me," he said. "It's you, and it's Ian, and it's Duncan, and it's Fergus, and it's Marsali. God help me, there's even Lyra to think of."
"Oh, let's don't," I said.
"Do you not understand?" he said, in near desperation. "I would lay the world at your feet, Claire. And I have nothing to give you."
He honestly thought it mattered. I sat looking at him, searching for words. He was half turned away, shoulders slumped in despair. Within an hour, I had gone from anguish at the thought of losing him in Scotland to a strong desire to bed him in the herbaceous borders, and from that to a pronounced urge to hit him on the head with an oar. Now, I was back to tenderness. At last, I took one big, calloused hand and slid forward, so I knelt on the boards between his knees. I laid my head against his chest and felt his breath stir my hair. I had no words, but I had made my choice. "Whither thou goest," I said, "I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest will I die, and there will I be buried." "Be it Scottish hill or southern forest." "You do what you have to. I'll be there." The water ran fast and shallow near the middle of the creek. I could see the boulders black just beneath the glinting surface. Jamie saw them too, and pulled strongly for the far side, bringing us to rest against a shelving gravel bank in a pool formed by the roots of a weeping willow. I leaned out and caught a branch of the willow and wrapped the painter round it. I had thought we would return to River Run, but evidently this expedition had some point beyond respite. We had continued upriver instead, Jamie pulling strongly against the slow current. Left alone with my thoughts, I could only listen to the faint hiss of his breath and wonder what he would do. If he chose to stay, well, it might not be as difficult as he thought. I didn't underrate Jocasta Cameron, but neither did I underestimate Jamie Fraser. Both Colum and Dougal Mackenzie had tried to bend him to their will, and both had failed. I had a moment's qualm at the memory of my last sight of Dougal Mackenzie, mouthing soundless curses as he drowned in his own blood, Jamie's dirk socketed at the base of his throat. "I am a violent man," he'd said. "You knew it." But he was still wrong. There was a difference between this man and Stephen Bonnet, I thought, watching the flex of his body on the oars, the grace and power of the sweep of his arms. He had several things beyond the honour that he claimed. Kindness, courage, and a conscience. I realised where we were going as he backed with one oar, steering across the current toward the mouth of a wide creek overhung with aspens. I had never approached by water before, but Jocasta had said it wasn't far. I shouldn't have been surprised. If he had come out tonight to confront his demons, it was a most appropriate place. A little way above the creek mouth, the mill loomed dark and silent. There was a dim glow behind its bulk, light from the slave shanties near the woods. We were surrounded by the usual night noises, but the place seemed strangely quiet, in spite of the racket made by trees and frogs and water. Though it was night, the huge building seemed to cast a shadow, though this was plainly no more than my imagination. "Places that are very busy in the daytime always seem particularly spooky at night," I said, in an effort to break the mill's silence.
"Do they?"
Jamie sounded abstracted.
"A dinner much like that one in the daylight."
I shuddered at the memory. Neither did I. I only meant...
"Burns is dead."
He didn't look at me. His face was turned toward the mill, half hidden by the willow shadow. I dropped the end of the rope. "The overseer? When?" I said, shocked more by the abruptness than the revelation. "And how?"
"This afternoon. Campbell's youngest lad brought the news just before sunset."
"How?" I asked again. I gripped my knees, a double handful of ivory silk twisted in my fingers.
"It was the lockjaw."
His voice was casual, unemphatic.
"A very nasty way to die."
He was right about that. I'd never actually seen anyone die of tetanus myself, but I knew the symptoms well enough. Restlessness and difficulty swallowing, developing into a progressive stiffening as the muscles of arms and legs and neck began to spasm. The spasms increased in severity and duration until the patient's body was hard as wood, arched in an agony that came on and receded, came on again, went off, and at last came on in an endless tetany that couldn't be relaxed by anything save death.
"He died grinning," Ronnie Campbell said, "but I shouldn't think it was a happy death forby."
It was a grim joke, but there was little humour in his voice. I sat up quite straight, feeling cold all down my spine in spite of the warmth of the night. "It isn't a quick death either," I said. Suspicion spread cold tentacles through my mind. "It takes days to die of tetanus."
"It took Davy Burns 5 days first to last."
If there'd been any trace of humour in his voice to start with, it was gone now. "You saw him," I said, a small flicker of anger beginning to thaw the internal chill. "You saw him, and you didn't tell me?" I had dressed Burns' injury, hideous but not life-threatening, and had been told that he would be kept somewhere safe until the disturbance over the lynching had died down. Heartsick as I was over the matter, I had made no effort to inquire further after the overseer's whereabouts or welfare. It was my own guilt at this neglect that made me angry, and I knew it. But the knowledge didn't help.
Could you have done anything? I thought you told me that the lockjaw was one of the things that couldn't be helped, even in your time.
He wasn't looking at me. I could see his profile turned toward the mill, head stamped in darker black against the lighter shadow of pale leaves. I forced myself to let go of my skirt. I smoothed the crumpled patches over my knee, thinking dimly that Phèdre would have a terrible time ironing it.
No, I said, with a little effort. No, I couldn't have saved him. But I should have seen him. I might have eased him a little.
Now he did look at me. I saw his head turn and felt the shifting of his weight in the boat.
You might, he said evenly.
And you wouldn't let me... I stopped, remembering his absences this past week and his evasive replies when I'd asked him where he'd been. I could imagine the scene all too well. The tiny, stifling attic room in Farquhar Campbell's house where I had dressed Byrne's injury. The racked figure on the bed dying by inches under the cold eyes of those the law had made his unwilling allies, knowing that he died despised. The sense of cold came back, raising goose flesh on my arms.
No, I wouldn't let Campbell send for you, he said softly. There's the law, Sassenach, and there is justice. I ken the difference well enough.
There's such a thing as mercy, too. And had anyone asked, I would have called Jamie Fraser a merciful man. He had been, once. But the years between now and then had been hard ones, and compassion was a soft emotion, easily eroded by circumstance. I had thought he still had his kindness, though, and felt a queer pain at the thought of its loss.
I shouldn't think so. No.
Had that been no more than honesty? The boat had drifted halfway round, so that the drooping branch hung now between us. There was a small snort from the darkness behind the leaves.
Blessed are the merciful, he said, for they shall find mercy. Burns wasn't, and he didn't. And as for me, once God had made his opinion of the man known, I didn't think it right to interfere.
You think God gave him tetanus?
I cannot think anyone else would have had the imagination for it. Besides, he went on logically, where else would you look for justice?
I searched for words and failed to find any. Giving up, I returned to the only possible point of argument. I felt a little sick.
You ought to have told me, even if you didn't think I could help. It wasn't your business to decide.
I didn't want you to go.
His voice was still quiet, but there was a note of steel in it now.
I know you didn't, but it doesn't matter whether you thought Burns deserved to suffer or...
Not for him.
The boat rocked suddenly as he moved, and I grasped the sides to keep my balance. He spoke violently.
I didn't care a fig whether Burns died easy or hard, but I'm no monster of cruelty. I didn't keep you from him to make him suffer. I kept ye away to protect you.
I was relieved to hear this, but increasingly angry as the truth of what he'd done dawned on me.
It wasn't your business to decide that. If I'm not your conscience, it isn't up to you to be mine.
I brushed angrily at the screen of willow fronds between us, trying to see him. Suddenly, a hand shot through the leaves and grabbed my wrist.
It's up to me to keep you safe.
I tried to jerk away, but he had a tight grip on me and he wasn't letting go. I am not a young girl who needs protection, nor yet an idiot. If there's some reason for me not to do something, then tell me and I'll listen.
But you can't decide what I'm to do and where I'm to go without even consulting me. I won't stand for that, and you bloody well know it.
The boat lurched, and with a huge rustling of leaves, he popped his head through the willow, glaring.
I'm not trying to say where you'll go.
You decided where I mustn't go, and that's just as bad.
The willow leaves slid back over his shoulders as the boat moved, jarred by his violence, and we revolved slowly, coming out of the tree's shadow. He loomed in front of me, massive as the mill, his head and shoulders blotting out a good bit of the scenery behind him. The long, straight nose was an inch from mine, and his eyes had gone narrow. They were a dark enough blue to be black in this light, and looking into them at close range was most unnerving. I blinked. He didn't. He had let go of my wrist when he came through the leaves. Now he took hold of my upper arms. I could feel the heat of his grip through the cloth. His hands were very big and very hard, making me suddenly aware of the fragility of my own bones in contrast. I am a violent man. He'd shaken me a time or two before, and I hadn't liked it. In case he had something of the sort in mind just now, I inserted a foot between his legs and prepared to give him a swift knee where it would do most good.
"I was wrong," he said.
Tensed for violence, I'd actually started to jerk my foot up when I heard what he had said. Before I could stop, he had clamped his legs tight together, trapping my knee between his thighs.
"I said I was wrong, Sassenach," he repeated, a touch of impatience in his voice. "Do you mind?"
No, I said, feeling a trifle sheepish. I wriggled my knee tentatively, but he kept his thighs squeezed tight together. "You wouldn't consider letting go of me, would you?" I said politely. My heart was still pounding.
"No, I wouldn't. Are you going to listen to me now?"
"I suppose so," I said, still polite. "It doesn't look as though I'm very busy at the moment."
I was close enough to see his mouth twitch. His thighs squeezed tighter for a moment, then relaxed.
"This is a very foolish quarrel, and you know that as well as I do."
"No, I don't." My anger had faded somewhat, but I wasn't about to let him dismiss it altogether. "And maybe it's not important to you, but it is to me. It isn't foolish, and you know it, or you wouldn't be admitting you're wrong."
The twitch was more pronounced this time. He took a deep breath and dropped his hands from my shoulders.
"Well, then, I should maybe have told you about Burns, I admit it. But if I had, you would have gone to him, even if I'd said it was the lockjaw. And I kent it was. I've seen it before. Even if there was nothing you could do, you'd still go, no?"
"Yes. Even if... yes, I would have gone."
In fact, there was nothing I could have done for Burns. Maya's anaesthetic wouldn't have helped a case of tetanus. Nothing short of injectable Karari would ease those spasms. I could have given him nothing more than the comfort of my presence, and it was doubtful that he would have appreciated that, or even noticed it. Still, I would have felt bound to offer it.
"I would have had to go," I said more gently. "I'm a doctor. Don't you see?"
"Of course I do," he said gruffly. "Do you think I dinna ken ye at all, Sassenach?"
Without waiting for an answer, he went on.
"There was talk about what had happened at the mill. There would be, aye. But with the man dying under your hands as he did, well, no one said straight out that you might have killed him on purpose. But it's easy to see folk thinking it. Not thinking that you killed him, even, but only that you might have thought to let him die on purpose, so as to save him from the rope."
I stared at my hands spread out on my knees, nearly as pale as the ivory satin under them.
"I did think of it."
"I ken that fine, aye," he said dryly. "I saw your face, Sassenach."
I drew a deep breath, if only to assure myself that the air was no longer thick with the smell of blood. There was nothing but the turpentine scent of the pine forest, clean and astringent in my nostrils. I had a sudden vivid memory of the hospital, of the smell of pine-scented disinfectant that hung in the air, that overlaid but couldn't banish the underlying smell of sickness. I took another cleansing breath and raised my head to look at Jamie.
"And did you wonder if I'd killed him?"
He looked faintly surprised.
"You would have done as you thought best."
He dismissed the minor question of whether I'd killed a man in favour of the point at issue.
"But it didn't seem wise for you to preside over both deaths, if you take my meaning."
I did. And not for the first time I was aware of the subtle networks of which he was a part in a way I could never be. This place, in its way, was as strange to him as it was to me. And yet he knew not only what people were saying, anyone could find that out who cared to haunt tavern and market, but what they were thinking. What was more irritating was that he knew what I was thinking.
"So you see," he said, watching me, "a Kent Burns was sure to die, and you couldn't help. Yet if you knew his trouble, you'd surely go to him. And then he would die, and folk would maybe not see how strange it was that both men had died under your hands, so to speak, but..."
"But they'd be thinking it," I finished for him. The twitch grew into a crooked smile.
"Folk notice you, Sassanach."
I bit my lip. For good or ill, they did, and the noticing had come close to killing me more than once. He rose, and taking hold of a branch for balance, stepped out on the gravel and pulled the plaid up over his shoulder.
"I told Mrs. Burns I would fetch away her husband's things from the mill," he said. "You needn't come if you dinna wish."
The mill loomed against the star-spattered sky. It couldn't have looked more sinister if it had tried.
"Whither thou goest, I will go."
I thought I knew now what he was doing. He had wanted to see it all before making up his mind. See it with the knowledge that it might be his. Walking through the gardens and orchards, rowing past the acres of thick pines, visiting the mill. He was surveying the domain he was offered, weighing and evaluating, deciding what complications must be dealt with, and whether he could or would accept the challenge.
"After all," I thought sourly, "the devil had insisted on showing Jesus everything he was passing up, taking him up to the top of the temple to gaze on the cities of the world."
The only difficulty was that if Jamie decided to fling himself off, there wasn't a legion of angels standing by to stop him dashing his foot, and everything else, against a slab of Scottish granite. Only me. "Wait," I said, clambering out of the boat. "I'm coming too." The lumber was still stacked in the mill yard. No one had moved any of it since the last time I had been here. The dark took away all sense of perspective. The stacks of fresh timber were pale rectangles that seemed to float above an invisible ground, first distant, then suddenly looming close enough to brush my skirts. The air smelt of pine sap and sawdust.
I couldn't see the ground under my own feet, for that matter, obscured as it was both by darkness and by my billowing ivory skirt.
Jamie held my arm to keep me from stumbling. He never stumbled, of course. Perhaps living all his life without even the thought of light outside after sunset had given him some sort of radar, I thought, like a bat. There was a fire burning somewhere among the slave huts. It was very late. Most would be sleeping. In the Indies there would have been the night-long sound of drums and keening. The slaves would have made lamentations for a fellow's death, a festival of mourning to last the week. Here there was nothing. No sound save the pine trees soughing, no flicker of movement save the faint light at the forest's edge.
"They're afraid," Jamie said softly, pausing to listen to the silence, as I did.
"Little wonder," I said, half under my breath. "So am I."
He made a small huffing sound that might have been amusement.
"So am I," he muttered, "but not of ghosts."
He took my arm and pushed open the small man door at the side of the mill before I could ask what he was afraid of. The silence inside had a body to it. At first, I thought it like the eerie quiet of dead battlefields. But then I realized the difference. This silence was alive, and whatever lived in the silence here, it wasn't lying quiet. I thought I could still smell the blood thick on the air. Then I breathed deeply and thought again, cold horror rippling up my spine. I could smell blood. Fresh blood. I gripped Jamie's arm, but he had smelled it himself. His arm had gone hard under my hand, muscles tensed in wariness. Without a word, he detached himself from my grip and vanished. For a moment I thought he truly had vanished, and nearly panicked, groping for him, my hand closing on the empty air where he'd stood. Then I realized that he'd merely flung the dark plaid over his head, instantly hiding the paleness of face and linen shirt. I heard his step, quick and light, on the dirt floor, and then that was gone too. The air was hot and still and thick with blood. A rank, sweet smell with a metal taste on the back of the tongue, exactly the same as it had been a week ago, conjuring hallucination. Still in the grip of a cold grue, I swung around and strained my eyes toward the far side of the cavernous room, half expecting to see the scene engraved on my memory materialize again out of darkness. The rope stretched tight from the lumber crane, the huge hook swaying with its groaning burden. A groan rent the air, and I nearly bit my lip in two. My throat swelled with a swallowed scream. Only the fear of drawing something to me kept me silent. Where was Jamie? I longed to call out for him, but didn't dare. My eyes had grown enough accustomed to the dark to make out the shadow of the saw blade, an amorphous blob 10 feet away. But the far side of the room was a wall of blackness. I strained my eyes to see, realizing belatedly that in my pale dress I was undoubtedly visible to anyone in the room with me. The groan came again, and I started convulsively. My palms were sweating. "It's not," I told myself fiercely. "It isn't. It can't be." I was paralyzed with fear, and it took some moments for me to realize what my ears had told me. The sound hadn't come from the blackness across the room where the crane stood with its hook. It had come from somewhere behind me. I whirled. The door we had come through was still open, a pale rectangle in the pitch black. Nothing showed. Nothing moved between me and the door. I took a quick step toward it and stopped. Every muscle in my legs strained to run like hell, but I couldn't leave Jamie. Again the sound, the same sobbing gasp of physical anguish. Pain past the point of crying out. With it, a new thought popped into my mind. What if it was Jamie making the sound? Shocked out of caution, I turned toward the sound and shouted his name, raising echoes from the roof high above. "Jamie!" I cried again. "Where are you?"
"Hier, Sassenach."
Jamie's muffled voice came from somewhere to my left, calm but somehow urgent.
"Come to me, will you?"
It wasn't him. Nearly shaking with relief at the sound of his voice, I blundered through the dark, not caring now what had made the sound, as long as it wasn't Jamie. My hand struck a wooden wall, groped blindly, and finally found a door standing open. He was inside the overseer's quarters. I stepped through the door and felt the change at once. The air was even closer and much hotter than that in the mill proper. The floor here was of wood, but there was no echo to my step. The air was dead still, suffocating, and the smell of blood was even stronger. "Where are you?" I called again, low voice this time.
"Here," came the reply, startlingly near at hand, "by the bed. Come and help me. It's a lass."
He was in the tiny bedroom. The small room was windowless and lightless, too. I found them by feel, Jamie kneeling on the wooden floor beside a narrow bed, and in the bed, a body. It was a female, as he'd said. Touch told me that at once. Touch told me also that she was exsanguinating. The cheek I brushed was cool and clammy. Everything else I touched was warm and wet. Her clothing, the bedclothes, the mattress beneath her. I could feel wetness soaking through my skirt where I knelt on the floor. I felt for a pulse in the throat and couldn't find it. The chest moved slightly under my hand, the only sign of life beyond the faint sigh that went with it. "It's all right now," I heard myself saying, and my voice was soothing, all trace of panic gone, though in truth there was more reason for it now. "We're here. You're not alone. What's happened to you? Can you tell me?" All the time my hands were darting over head and throat and chest and stomach, pushing sodden clothes aside, searching blindly, frantically for a wound to staunch. Nothing. No spurt of artery. No raw gash. And all the time there was a faint but steady pitter-pat, pitter-pat, like the sound of tiny feet running. "Tell." It wasn't so much a word as the articulation of a sigh, then a catch, a sobbing breath indrawn.
"Who has done this to you, lass?" Jamie's disembodied voice came low and urgent. "Tell me, who?"
"Tell." I touched all the places where the great vessels lie close beneath the skin and found them whole. Seized her by an unresisting arm and lifted, thrust a hand beneath to feel her back. All the heat of her body was there. The bodice was damp with sweat, but not blood-soaked. "It will be all right," I said again. "You're not alone. Jamie, hold her hand." Hopelessness came down on me. I knew what it must be.
"I already have it," he said to me, and, "Dinner trouble, lass," to her. "It will be all right, do you hear me?"
Pitter-pat, pitter-pat. The tiny feet were slowing. "Tell." I couldn't help, but nonetheless slid my hand beneath her skirt again, this time letting my fingers curve between the limp, splayed thighs. She was still warm here, very warm. Blood flowed gently over my hand and through my fingers, hot and wet as the air around us, unstoppable as the water that flowed down the mill's sluice.
"I die?"
"I think you're murdered, lass,"
Jamie said to her very gently.
"Will you not see who has killed you?"
Her breath came louder now, a soft rattle in her throat. Pit. Pat. The feet were tiptoeing softly now.
"Sergeant, tell him."
I drew my hand out from between her thighs and took her other hand in mine, heedless of the blood. It scarcely mattered now, after all.
"Tell,"
came with sudden intensity, and then silence. A long silence, and then another long sighing breath. A silence even longer, and a breath.
"I will," said Jamie. His voice was no more than a whisper in the dark. "I will do it, I promise you."
Pit. Pat. They called it the death drop in the Highlands, the sound of dripping water, heard in a house when one of the inhabitants was about to die. Not water dripping here, but a sure sign nonetheless. There was no more sound from the darkness. I couldn't see Jamie, but felt the slight movement of the bed against my thighs as he leaned forward.
"God will forgive you," he whispered to the silence.
"Go in peace." I could hear the buzzing the moment we stepped into the overseer's quarters the next morning. In the huge, dusty silence of the mill, everything had been muffled in space and sawdust. But in this small, partitioned area, the walls caught every sound and threw it back. Our footsteps echoed from wooden floor to wooden ceiling. I felt like a fly sealed inside a snare drum, and suffered a moment's claustrophobia, trapped as I was in the narrow passage between the two men. There were only two rooms, separated by a short passage that led from the outdoors into the mill proper. On our right lay the larger room that had served the Burnses for living and cooking, and on the left, the smaller bedroom from which the noise was coming. Jamie took a deep breath, clasped his plaid to his face, and pulled open the bedroom door. It looked like a blanket covering the bed, a blanket of gunmetal blue sparked with green. Then Jamie took a step into the room, and the flies rose, buzzing from their clotted meal in a swarm of gluttonous protest. I bit back a cry of abhorrence, and ducked, flailing at them. Bloated, slow-moving bodies hit my face and arms and bounced away, circling lazily through the thick air. Farquhar Campbell made a Scottish noise of overpowering disgust that sounded like, yuck, then lowered his head and pushed past me, eyes slitted and lips pressed tight together, nostrils pinched to whiteness. The tiny bedroom was hardly bigger than the coffin it had become. There were no windows, only cracks between the boards that let in a dim, uncertain light. The atmosphere was hot and humid as a tropical greenhouse, thick with the rotting, sweet smell of death. I could feel the sweat snaking down my sides, ticklish as flies' feet, and tried to breathe only through my mouth. She hadn't been large. Her body made only the slightest mound beneath the blanket we had laid over her the night before for decency's sake. Her head seemed big by contrast to the shrunken body, like a child's stick figure with a round ball stuck on toothpick limbs. Brushing away several flies too glutted to move, Jamie pulled back the blanket. The blanket, like everything else, was blotched and crusted, sodden at the foot. The human body, on average, contains 8 pints of blood, but it seems a lot more when you spread it around. I had seen her face briefly the night before. Dead features lent an artificial glow by the light of the pine splinter Jamie held above her. Now she lay pallid and dank as a mushroom, blunt features emerging from a web of fine brown hair. It was impossible to tell her age, save that she wasn't old. Neither could I tell whether she had been attractive. There was no beauty of bone, but animation might have flushed the round cheeks and lent her deep-set eyes a sparkle men might have found pretty. One man had, I thought. Pretty enough, anyway. The men were murmuring together, bent over the still form. Mr. Campbell turned now to me, wearing a slight frown beneath his formal wig.
"You are reasonably sure, Mrs. Fraser, of the cause of death?"
"Yes." Trying not to breathe the fetid air, I picked up the edge of the blanket and turned it back, exposing the corpse's legs. The feet were faintly blue and beginning to swell. "I drew her skirt down, but I left everything else as it was," I explained, pulling it up again. My stomach muscles tightened automatically as I touched her. I had seen dead bodies before, and this was far from the most gruesome. But the hot climate and closed atmosphere had prevented the body from cooling much. The flesh of her thigh was as warm as mine, but unpleasantly flaccid. I had left it where we found it, in the bed, between her legs. A kitchen skewer, more than a foot long. It was covered in dried blood as well, but clearly visible. I found no wound on the body, I said, putting it as delicately as possible.
I see.
Mr. Campbell's frown seemed to lessen slightly.
Ah, well, at least 'tis likely not a case of deliberate murder, then.
I opened my mouth to reply, but caught a warning look from Jamie. Not noticing, Mr. Campbell went on.
The question remains whether the poor woman will have done it herself or met her death by the agency of another. What think you, Mistress Fraser?
Jamie narrowed his eyes at me over Campbell's shoulder, but the warning was unnecessary. We had discussed the matter last night and come to our own conclusions, also to the conclusion that our opinions need not be shared with the forces of law and order in Cross Creek. Not just yet. I pinched my nose slightly under the pretext of the smell in order to disguise any telltale alteration of my expression. I was a very bad liar. "I'm sure she did it by herself," I said firmly. "It takes very little time to bleed to death in this manner. And, as Jamie told you, she was still alive when we found her. We were outside the mill, talking, for some time before we came in. No one would have been able to leave without our seeing them."
On the other hand, a person might quite easily have hidden in the other room and crept out quietly in the dark while we were occupied in comforting the dying woman.
If this possibility didn't occur to Mr. Campbell, I saw no reason to draw it to his attention.
Jamie had rearranged his features into an expression of gravity suitable to the occasion by the time Mr. Campbell turned back to him. The older man shook his head in regret.
"Ah, poor unfortunate lass. I suppose we can but be relieved that no one else has shared her sin."
"What about the man who fathered the child she was trying to get rid of?" I said, with a certain amount of acidity.
Mr. Campbell looked startled, but pulled himself quickly back together.
"Quite so," he said, and coughed. "Though we do not know whether she were married." "So you do not know the woman yourself, sir?"
Jamie butted in before I could make any further injudicious remarks. Campbell shook his head.
"She is not a servant of Mr. Buchanan or the McNeils, I am sure, nor Judge Alderdice. Those are the only plantations near enough from which she might have walked. Though it does occur to me to wonder why she should have come to this particular place to perform such a desperate act."
It had occurred to Jamie and me, too. To prevent Mr. Campbell's taking the next step in this line of inquiry, Jamie intervened again.
"She said very little, but she did mention a sergeant. 'Tell the sergeant,' were her words. Do you perhaps have a thought whom she might mean by that, sir?"
"I think there is an army sergeant in charge of the guard on the Royal Warehouse. Yes, I'm sure of it."
Mr. Campbell brightened slightly.
"Ah, nae doot the woman was attached in some way to the military establishment. Depend upon it, that is the explanation.
Though I still wonder why she..."
"Mr. Campbell, do pardon me. I'm afraid I'm feeling a bit faint," I interrupted, laying a hand on his sleeve. This was no lie. I hadn't slept or eaten. I felt light-headed from the heat and the smell, and I knew I must look pale.
"Will you see my wife outside, sir?" Jamie said.
He gestured toward the bed and its pathetic burden.
"I'll bring the poor lass along, as I may." "Pray do not trouble yourself, Mr. Fraser," Campbell protested, already turning to usher me out. "My servant can fetch out the body." "It's my aunt's mill, sir, and that's my concern."
Jamie spoke politely but firmly.
"I shall attend to it."
Phedre was waiting outside by the wagon.
"I told you that place got hints," she said, surveying me with an air of grim satisfaction. "You white as airy sheet, ma'am."
She handed me a flask of spiced wine, wrinkling her nose delicately in my direction.
"You smellin' worse than what you was last night, and you look like you come from a pig killin' then. Sit you down in the shade here and drink that up. Fix you up, peart."
She glanced over my shoulder. I looked back as well and saw that Campbell had reached the shade of the sycamores by the creek bank and was deep in conversation with his servant.
"Found her,"
Phedra said at once, dropping her voice. Her eyes cut sideways toward the small cluster of slave huts barely visible from this side of the mill.
"You're sure? You didn't have much time."
I took a mouthful of wine and held it, glad of the sharp bouquet that rose up the back of my throat, cleansing my palate of the taste of death. Phaedra nodded, her glance moving to the men under the trees.
Didn't need much. Walked down by them houses, saw one door hanging open. Little bits of trash scattered round like somebody done left in a hurry. I find a pickin' in and ask him who living there. He tell me Polly Ann lived there, but she gone now. He don't know where. Ask him when she leave. He say she there for supper last night. This morning she gone. Nobody see her.
Her eyes met mine, dark with questions.
Now you know. What do you mean to do?
A bloody good question, and one for which I had no answer at all. I swallowed the wine, and along with it, a rising sense of panic. All the slaves here must know she's gone. How long before anyone else finds out? Whose business would it be to know such things now that Burns is dead? Phaedra raised one shoulder in a graceful shrug.
Anybody come asking, find out right quick. But whose business it be to ask?
She nodded toward the mill. We had left the small door to the living quarters open. Jamie was coming out, a blanket-wrapped burden cradled in his arms.
"Reckon it's his," she said.
"I'm already part of it."
He had known, even before the interrupted dinner party. With no formal announcement, with neither invitation nor acceptance of the role, he fit the place, the part, like a piece slipping into a jigsaw puzzle. Already he was the master of River Run, if he wanted to be. Campbell's servant had come out to help with the body. Jamie sank to one knee by the edge of the mill flume, surrendering his burden gently to the earth. I gave Phaedra back the flask with a nod of thanks. "Will you fetch the things from the wagon?" Without a word, Phaedra went to get the things I had brought. A blanket, a bucket, clean rags, and a jar of herbs, while I went to join Jamie. He was kneeling by the creek, washing his hands, a little way upstream from where the body lay. It was foolish to wash in preparation for what I was about to do, but habit was strong. I knelt beside him and dipped my hands as well, letting the cold, fresh rush of water carry away the touch of clammy flesh. "I was right," I said to him, low-voiced. "It was a woman called Polly Ann. She's run away in the night." He grimaced, rubbing his palms briskly together, and glanced over his shoulder. Campbell was standing over the corpse now, a slight frown of distaste still on his face. Jamie scowled in concentration, gaze returning to his hands.
Well, I'll put a cocked hat on it, eh?"
He bent and splashed his face, then shook his head violently, flinging drops like a wet dog. Then he gave me a nod and stood up, wiping his face with the end of his stained plaid.
"See to the lassie, aye, Sassenach."
He stalked purposefully toward Mr. Campbell, plaid swinging. There was no use saving any of her clothes. I cut them off. Undressed, she looked to be in her 20s. Undernourished, ribs countable, arms and legs slender and pale as stripped branches. For all that, she was still surprisingly heavy, and the remnants of rigor mortis made her hard to handle. Phaedra and I were both sweating heavily before we finished, and strands of hair were escaping from the knot at my neck and pasting themselves to my flushed cheeks. At least the heavy labor kept conversation to a minimum, leaving me in peace with my thoughts. Not that my thoughts were particularly peaceful. A woman seeking to slip a bairn, as Jamie put it, would do it in her own room, her own bed, if she were doing it alone. The only reason for the stranger to have come to a remote place such as this was to meet the person who would do the office for her. A person who couldn't come to her. We must look for a slave in the mill quarters, I had told him. One, maybe, with the reputation of a midwife. Someone women would talk about among themselves, would recommend in whispers. The fact that I had apparently been proved right gave me no satisfaction. The abortionist had fled, fearing that the woman would have told us who had done the deed. If she had stayed put and said nothing, Farquhar Campbell might have taken my word for it that the woman must have done it herself. He could hardly prove otherwise. If anyone else found that the slave Polly Ann had run, though, and of course they would find out, and she were caught and questioned, the whole matter would no doubt come out at once. And then what? I shuddered, despite the heat. Did the law of bloodshed apply in this case? It certainly ought, I thought, grimly sluicing yet another bucket of water over the splayed white limbs, if quantity counted for anything. Damn the woman, I thought, using irritation to cover a useless pity. I could do nothing for her now, save to try to tidy up the mess she had left, in every sense of the word. And perhaps try to save the other player in this tragedy, the hapless woman who had done murder unmeaning, in the guise of help, and who stood now to pay for that mistake with her own life. Jamie had gotten the wine flask, I saw. He was passing it back and forth with Farquhar Campbell, the two talking intently, occasionally turning to gesture at the mill or back toward the river or the town.
"You got anything I can comb her out with, ma'am?"
Phaedra's question pulled my attention back to the job at hand. She was squatting by the body, fingering the tangled hair critically.
"Wouldn't like to put her in the ground looking like this, poor child," she said, shaking her head.
"I thought Phaedra was likely not much older than the dead woman. And in any case, it scarcely mattered that the corpse should go to its grave well-groomed. Still, I groped in my pocket and came up with a small ivory comb, with which Phaedra set to work, humming under her breath. Mr. Campbell was taking his leave. I heard the creak of his team's harness and their small stamping of anticipation as the groom settled himself. Mr. Campbell saw me and bowed deeply, hat held low. I sketched him a curtsy in return, and watched with relief as he drove away. Phaedra, too, had stopped her work and was gazing after the departing carriage. She said something under her breath and spat in the dust. It was done without apparent malice, a charm against evil that I'd seen before. She looked up at me.
"Mr. Jamie best find that Polly Ann afore sunset. Be wild animals in the piney wood, and Mr. Ulysses say that woman worth 200 pound when Mr. Castor buy her. She don't know the woods, that Polly Ann. She be come straight from Africa no more than a year agone."
Without further comment, she bent her head over her task, fingers moving dark and quick as a spider among the fine silk of our corpse's hair. I bent to my work as well, realizing with something of a shock that the web of circumstance that enmeshed Jamie had touched me too. I didn't stand outside, as I had thought, and couldn't, if I wanted to. Phaedra had helped me to find Polly Ann, not because she trusted or liked me, but because I was the master's wife. Polly Ann must be found and hidden. And Jamie, she thought, would of course find Polly Ann and hide her. She was his property. Or Jocasta's, which in Phaedra's eyes would amount to the same thing. At last the stranger lay clean on the worn linen sheet I had brought for a shroud. Phaedra had combed her hair and braided it. I took out the big stone jar of herbs. I had brought them as much from habit as from reason, but now was glad of them, not so much for aid against the progress of decomposition, but as the sole and necessary touch of ceremony. It was difficult to reconcile this clumsy, reeking lump of clay with the small, cold hand that had grasped mine, with the anguished whisper that had breathed, "Tell," in the smothering dark. And yet there was the memory of her, of the last of her living blood spilling hot in my hand, more vivid in my mind than this sight of her empty flesh, naked in the hands of strangers. There was no minister nearer than Halifax. She would be buried without rites. And yet, what need had she of rites? Funeral rituals are for the comfort of the bereaved. It was unlikely that she'd left anyone behind to grieve, I thought. For if she had had anyone so close to her, family, husband, or even lover, I thought she wouldn't now be dead. I hadn't known her, wouldn't miss her. But I grieved her, her and her child.